Daily Frequencies open, and welcome to Enterprising Individuals, the Star Trek discussion podcast that boldly goes into excruciating detail about the series, characters, and stories of the Star Trek universe. I'm your host, Aaron Coker, a.k.a. Caliban, and my favorite Tony Award-winning actress is Madeline Kahn. I'm joined on this episode once again by Darren Mooney. Darren is a columnist, film critic, and YouTube host for The Escapist magazine. He's also the co-host of the 250 podcast, a look at the top 250 films on IMDb. He's also an author. His books, Christopher Nolan, A Critical Study of the Films, and Opening the X-Files, A Critical History of the Original Series, are available on Amazon. Darren, welcome back to the show.
No worries. I'm glad that we can do this.
We can do this. Yes. It's great to have you back aboard, and today we'll be talking about the second Kelvin timeline film and the 12th Star Trek feature, Star Trek Into Darkness. With Star Trek 2009, Paramount had a bona fide hit on its hands, thanks to the efforts of director and producer J.J. Abrams and his in-demand writers Alex Kurtzman and Roberto Orci. The future of Trek once again seemed bright, thoughts of Nemesis were long forgotten, and Tom Hardy was well on his way to being Hollywood's most swollest leading man. The packed schedule of Abrams and his crew meant that Star Trek fans would have to be patient for a sequel, but Into Darkness finally crashed into theaters in 2013 to near-universal praise and a larger box office return than its predecessor. But as the dust of Alcatraz and Fisherman's Wharf settled, a creeping sentiment began to infect the legacy of the film, an audience-wide icebox moment that threatened to chill the film's initially warm reception. Was Into Darkness any good? Star Trek 2009 had been received as an energetic, if somewhat superficial, reimagining of the adventures of the Enterprise crew, retaining the series' sci-fi milieu, but broadening its appeal for a wider audience. Darkness went even further down that road, recycling the franchise's most infamous villain and restaging scenes from Trek's most beloved sequel in an effort to add lens flare-filled panache to familiar elements. But some fans began to question how Star Trek's new caretakers would define Trek for a new millennium, and whether they were up to the task of leading the franchise towards the light and not into darkness. But we'll talk about that a little later in the show. First, Darren, it's great to have you back on the podcast, and we've got our work cut out for us with our main subject today. But I would be remiss if I passed on the chance to once more pick your brain regarding the current state of media, specifically the shifting fortunes of streaming TV, the greatly exaggerated death of the movie theater, the funeral of TV's golden age, all of which are subjects that you have covered recently on your In the Frame segments for The Escapist.
Yeah, no, thanks very much. It's there's a lot to talk about, and it's kind of really interesting when I make those videos or I do those kind of slots for The Escapist, where I'll put them together, and obviously they go off to the ender. It's mostly Omar Ahmed who does a fantastic job. Also, Matt J. Lachlan does an amazing job as well. And it takes, about a week in terms of turnaround before that goes back to, like, subscribers, and then a week again until it goes back to, like, this regular people who subscribe on YouTube. And it's always fascinating to see what has happened within those 2 weeks that either makes the piece I wrote seem brilliantly prescient or horrendously dated within that kind of narrow gap of time. Like, I think this week, or as we're recording this, I offhand made some reference to how Mike Waldron was Kevin Feige's go-to guy. And literally, as we released that video to, like, the wider internet, it's announced that, oh yeah, Kevin Feige has picked Mike Waldron to write the big Secret Wars movie. So it's like, yay, bingo. Yeah. And I think I make some sort of crack on this week's video about, like, the Game of Thrones, the infamous The Long Night, the darkness, the controversy over how difficult it was to watch an episode of a Game of Thrones TV show directed by Miguel Sapochnik. And then what happens literally as we release that episode?
Sapochnik strikes again.
Sapochnik strikes back.
a literal
shot in the dark. It's what would happen if you took the final shot of The Sopranos and extended it over a full hour of television we're about to find out. So it's really fun to get to do that stuff. I'm really thrilled to work with the people that I do. It's a fantastic opportunity.
It's great. I mean, when you talk about these issues comprehensively, as you do, you run into those problems. But one of the things that I like about your videos is they aren't just this TV show's good, this movie's bad, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, sometimes they cover that, but you're taking on the core issues that we're seeing in mass media today. And what I want to know is, like, do you have a lot of latitude in what you're allowed to explore? What's your relationship like with editorial? Do you get to pick your own sort of subjects?
Well, what will generally happen with Nick, who's my editor, he's the guy who basically found me on Twitter and was like, hey, instead of writing like 200 tweet long threads.
Hey, talking to this camera.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's like, what if you wrote these things we call articles? And what if sometimes you converted those articles into videos? And I was like, what are these two new technologies that you're mentioning to me? Long form writing and audio recording. So what typically happen is for the articles, I'll pitch about 10 subjects to Nick every Monday and every Friday, and he'll pick one that sounds good to him. Or occasionally we'll just chat randomly about stuff and he'll ask me questions and he'll be like, okay, well, let's explore that. Like, for example, this week, one I'm very proud of was about writers, and in particular, the issue with writing on franchise media. And it's something that a couple of people have mentioned in passing, kind of casually in conversation to me, and Nick brought it up as well, which is the idea that, like, the most expensive show in the history of television is being written, not to step on next week's episode of Enterprising Individuals, but is being written by these two guys whose most important credit to this point is an uncredited rewrite on Star Trek Beyond. How does that happen?
Like, how did they get there?
How did they get there? How did the circumstances end up that when Amazon was like, we want to compete with Game of Thrones, we want to spend, you know, $712 million on a first season of this show, and in fact, I guarantee by the time you've released this, some news report has come out and revealed it's even more. But like, how do you end up with a situation where the two people sitting at the other end of the table have little to no writing experience whatsoever? So Nick kind of asked me that question. I'd been thinking about it a bit anyway, so that kind of became the video. But generally what will happen is there'll be a bit of editorial steer, particularly for the videos, because the videos are more sensitive in terms of they're on YouTube, they've got a higher audience, they're more dynamic, they're more transparent in terms of, say, viewership. And anybody who is at all familiar with online media will be aware that the YouTube comment section in particular and the YouTube algorithm are very delicate creatures that can be very easily provoked. Like, one famous example is a couple of weeks ago, I was talking about Better Call Saul. I think I was specifically talking about, like, the era of the golden age of television, how it drew from 70s cinema. And in that video, there's a very quick shot from All That Jazz, fantastic movie if you haven't seen it, Bob Fosse's one.
Yeah.
But where what's his name? It's Rob Schneider. Roy Scheider, sorry, apologies. I always get the Scheiders confused.
Rob Schneider.
All That Jazz. And then you have to imagine Roy Scheider in, is it, what's it called? The Animal? Is that what it is? Or the Hot Chick?
Yeah, right. The Hot Chick.
But it's like, The Pest is John Leguizamo. Sorry, I've got all my terrible comedies confused. But there's a moment where Roy Scheider, like, puts a prescription pill in his hand and downs it down his throat and says, it's showtime. And we include that as a kind of an illustration of how, like, Better Call Saul uses a reference to that quite frequently. But that got flagged by the YouTube algorithm for recreational drug use. Which is fascinating. So we tend to be a bit more sensitive when it comes to the videos. And what will happen there is, a couple of weeks beforehand, I'll sit down with Nick and we'll map down what's happening in pop culture. So we'll go, okay, this week we're releasing, that's the same week that House of the Dragon's premiering. So it would be great if we had something on, say, Game of Thrones to go out live with that. Or, you know, this week Rings of Power is premiering, so something to go with that. Or Andor, for example. And so I'll sit down and I'll kind of hammer those out. But occasionally it'll happen that nothing is coming out this week or there's a gap week, in which case we'll kind of go and we'll talk through and figure out kind of what's interesting to both of us and what we think people might like to listen to. And we do also, to be fair, and particularly, like, to Nick's credit, again, I cannot speak highly enough of, like, the editorial team at The Escapist. If anybody actually likes the work that I do there, a lot of that is down to other people pointing me in the right direction who know what they're doing. But Nick is always very helpful in terms of pointing me towards things that the audience is interested in. So comments or conversations that are happening that people want to maybe hear more of or know more about. I was very thrilled. I got to, like, call my own shot and, like, make a joke about how I wanted to make a video about, say, the direction of Sam Raimi's Multiverse of Madness. And through, like, sheer power of will, I managed to manifest a video where we talk for 10 minutes about, like, Sam Raimi's movement of the camera in Multiverse of Madness, which is just something that is incredibly geeky, and I never would have thought that I get to do, But I'm really, really thrilled to have the chance to do that. So that's kind of where they come from and how they came to be.
There's an element as well of reading something or hearing something read rather than reading it off the page. You know, much has been made of the fact that it's hard to get nuance from something, a tweet or an article, to get the emotional intent of the author. But when you have to write something and then read it, and people hear it on YouTube, I would imagine that not only is the audience bigger on YouTube, but people are responding specifically to you and your inflection and what you're saying rather than just reading an article and saying, I don't know if I agree with that, or yeah, I do.
That guy seems to have disappeared up various parts of his own anatomy. I'm always very cautious about that, because again, anybody will tell you that they hate their own voice. I don't mean to project onto you, Aaron, but like most people I talk to are like, I hate the sound of my own voice. And I honestly do. I have a very high-pitched voice. It can be very shrill. I worry sometimes that I'm not very good at communicating intent. I'm told I can be very deadpan, very serious, that I come across as somebody who takes himself very seriously when I'm very much not doing that all the time. I was admittedly very, very sensitive about that. And I will actually go back. Well, I won't go back. I don't listen to myself. I try not to listen to myself. I have to do it on the video edits because, obviously that's a constructive process where you're like, I'd like if we could cut this bit or trim this bit, or if we could, like, if you could pause there. That's sort of stuff you have to. And at the end of the process, you're like, the work that the video editors do is amazing, but I never want to hear my own voice again. There have been cases where I've gone back and like people have pointed to old videos that I've done, and I don't think I'm particularly good at it now, but I think that when I go back and I listen to the early video recordings that I did, I'm very stilted. I'm very uncomfortable on mic. And I will actually, again, I will credit in particular Omar Ahmed for making me more comfortable on mic and kind of like talking me through how things come across, how they work, what editors need, how flow in particular works. Because again, if you're reading a piece, it's very different to what we're doing at the moment, which is kind of extemporizing and kind of talking casually, which is a lot easier. But if you're reading something you've written, hitting the right tone, hitting the right note, hitting the right cadence, pausing in the right places can be very difficult, and obviously, as you said, can fundamentally change the meaning of what you're saying in ways that can perhaps be provocative and misconstrued. It's an interesting medium. I'm still getting used to it. I'm not quite like Lal in The Offspring. Without understanding YouTube, I have somehow mastered it. I do not understand YouTube, and I certainly have not mastered it, but we're getting there.
I have a mouth and I am screaming. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, in my early days as an actor and a voice actor, I hated seeing myself on screen or hearing myself. But at this point as a podcaster, it's just a drone to me. You know, I don't even really register it as my own voice anymore. I'm just an editor who's just going, why'd he say that? Cut that out. And so, you get there eventually. Yeah.
Now, editing yourself in a podcast is like, how much of myself can I cut out when this still remains coherent?
How much of myself can anyone take? Because I've had enough. I feel like it's been 24 times that outlets have knelled the death of the golden age on TV. But assuming that they really mean it this time, what does post-golden age TV look like going forward from this point?
Well, I mean, that's the question, is that like everybody, the king is dead, long live the king. The question is like, you know, most people, I think, academically agree that the golden age is over. And again, you know, people would generally argue about when that occurs. Everybody's always like, let's shift the dial a little bit forward, a little bit back. Again, same thing happens at either end. I mean, The Sopranos is typically taken as the start, but you have people like Emily Nussbaum saying you should actually go back and you should count things like Buffy, for example. You should count things like Oz. Like, these things don't happen in a vacuum. There's no big bang moment. But I do give some credence to the idea that like the simultaneous overlapping endings of like, you know, the Breaking Bad and Mad Men are probably as easy a point as any to go. You could probably stretch The Americans a couple of years later, but I think we are definitely out of it. And I think what it looks like is interesting because it feels like, again, eras don't just start and end. If you pick the comic book medium, for example, it isn't like the Golden Age ends and the Silver Age starts. You have the Golden Age is during the Second World War. It kind of ends, it kind of fizzles out when you have the introduction of things like the Comics Books Code Authority. You have like Wertham's Seduction of the Innocent. You have all this sort of stuff happening. But then you have this weird period where like nobody's sure what's going on anymore and what comics are meant to look like. And then bam, you have, sorry, that was very dramatic. I apologize, listeners. I shouldn't be so enthusiastic. But then you have the Silver Age begins with, depending on who you ask, either the, you know, Fantastic Four number one or the appearance of the Silver Age Flash, Barry Allen.
Right. Flash Two Worlds.
Flash, yeah. Well, not even going back earlier than that, like when he premieres.
Sure.
Like, is it Showcase something? It showcases the issue. I can't remember what. He literally pops out the page again, the fourth wall right, breaking kind of Flash.
Yeah.
But. So I don't know if we are in, like, the Silver Age of television, or even what might be termed, the post-Golden Age of television, where it's an age defined by anything beyond the fact that we're past the Golden Age, where a lot of modern TV feels almost like a kind of a hangover when you compare it to the Golden Age. So things like, say, Ozark, for example, would be a show that I would pick as an example. However one feels about it, it feels like it's an imitation of a Golden Age show. The same thing with Ray Donovan. By the way, I have a friend who pointed out there's an insane amount of Ray Donovan GIFs available on Twitter. You could communicate entirely through Ray Donovan GIFs. And that is a show that I have never watched more than two episodes of, which I find amazing. It's everybody's dad's favorite show, but nobody's favorite show.
But you were talking about Yellowstone on one of your recent videos, another show that I haven't watched at all. But I was watching another media analysis show on YouTube, and they were talking about Yellowstone, and they put together like a sizzle reel to go under what they were talking about, and like there were like terrorist attacks and things are exploding and everybody's got machine guns, and I'm like, wait a minute, what is this show? I thought it was just about riding horses around.
It's Dynasty or Dallas, basically. Like it's
yeah,
good old...
fully automatic Dynasty. Yeah.
Well, I mean, they did bring back Dynasty and Dallas. They both came back to primetime television recently as well. Like that's the thing, is that like that's. Again, like Yellowstone is another example where you can trace the lineage of it through things like Breaking Bad or things like The Sopranos, but it's a less morally complex kind of show. It's much more comfortable. It's like I know it's technically, it's on Showtime, is it, or Paramount? It's a Paramount production.
I think it's Paramount.
It's Paramount, yeah. It's the biggest TV show on cable, I believe. But it's that for your dad. It's what if The Sopranos, but your dad could watch it? What if Deadwood, but your dad could watch it? That kind of thing. And that's fine. I've watched a lot of it. My parents do actually unironically love it, which is great. And like Kevin Costner is great. He deserves all the happiness in the world. Kelly Riley's also fantastic. Wes Bentley, like good. Everybody really happy to see them. Gil Birmingham's in there as well. Like really good cast. Very happy to see everybody making all that money and having all that fun. But there is a sense that we're not quite sure what next looks like, which is why I'm kind of so fascinated by things like The Rings of Power, where it part of me is like, are we reaching a stage? And again, it's reductive to say that history repeats, you know, history rhymes or whatever. But it does. I do wonder if we had this big argument back, say about 10, 15 years ago, around the time that blockbusters began emerging, which, you know, may or may not be a nice segue into Into Darkness, depending on when we get there. But we had this idea that, you know, in the 2000s, 2010s, you know, blockbuster cinema came to literally eat anything. The summer kind of like grew to the point where it started in March and it ended in October, which is just insane. You had like the colonization of Christmas by blockbusters like Star Wars and all this sort of stuff. And you had the idea that like the introduction of kind of super fauna, megafauna, where the hell do all the smaller creatures go? Where do the mid-budget movies go? Where do the movies aimed at adults go? And the argument was always, well, they go to television. Or counterpoint, they go to streaming services like Apple or like Netflix or like Amazon. But that's a completely separate discussion. But you have this idea that like television for a little while becomes home to the equivalent of what cinema was in, say, the 70s, you know, the new Hollywood movement, where you have these like bold, controversial, you know, anti-hero, morally ambiguous, conflicted depictions of modern American life reflected through various prisms. And part of me wonders if what we're seeing in modern television, and in particular through the lens of streaming, but also arguably, you know, on network television as well. I mean, you did, for example, you had, I think, a couple of weeks ago, the first Law & Order 3-part season premiere, a gigantic blockbuster crossover for the first time in the history of television, which was Law & Order Special Victims Unit and, I believe, Organized Crime. I don't know what the third one is. they're all Law and Order shows. Dick Wolf is eating. But you have you have this idea that streaming has become home to like all this franchise media. You know, we talk about the Marvel shows, which are arguably just Marvel blockbusters, but like 4 hours long and in six episodes. The Star Trek shows, which, you know, arguably, well, we may come back to like Strange New Worlds or Lower Decks or whatever. But you look at, say, Discovery and Picard, and they're very much like blockbuster kind of event series, long serialized stories that do have individual episodes, but are very much meant to be competing with what you'd normally see on a big screen. Rings of Power, we already mentioned. House of the Dragon, for example. The Star Wars shows, you know, The Mandalorian, The Book of Boba Fett, and obviously Andor at the moment as well. They're all like stuff that ironically was the stuff that pushed like adult mid-budget movies out of cinemas in the first place. But now it's coming to television. And so part of me does wonder if, and again, I'm always wary of being the chicken little sky is falling guy. Stuff will continue. Life finds a way. Everything will prevail. Everything will survive. Maybe not in the form that we think it will. And I kind of think you flagged the death of theaters, which may be something we come back to, because the death of theaters has been greatly exaggerated. And one of the great lessons of the streaming era has been the importance of a theatrical release for a streaming movie, no matter what it is. Even a bombing theatrical release adds value to a movie when you put it on streaming. Compare, again, off the top of my head, something like, say, Lightyear, which bombed in theaters. Probably the closest thing the year had to a major big budget bomb. But when it arrives on Disney Plus, because it was in theaters, it has intrinsic value, which makes it seem more important than something like Luck, for example, on Netflix, comparable animated show. But it does seem like modern streaming is now populated by the kinds of projects that like forced adult movies out of cinemas. So I do wonder now if we're going to see a situation where, particularly as, you know, eventually Disney will start consolidating its various streaming platforms, you'll see FX folding into Disney Plus, you'll see Hulu folding into Disney Plus inevitably, as things kind of like, as the brands begin to concentrate their value. Part of me wonders then, will you start seeing what happened in theaters or happened in cinemas happen to television? Where, you know, instead of getting like Dope Sick or The Drop or Mike or, you know, Pam and Tommy on Hulu or whatever, it'll all be under one Disney Plus brand, and most of that brand will be devoted to Star Wars or Marvel content. That's my very cynical, very weary worst case scenario. Kind of like Darren wakes up in a cold sweat in the middle of the night staring in, staring into darkness, ironically enough.
Yeah, right. There's you talk in some of your videos about the sort of push-pull between, you know, the presentation of auteur theory on TV and cinema and how it seems to be sort of bouncing back and forth, maybe centering on TV right now. And something that I was thinking about in terms of what we think of as the golden age of TV, like to me, and I think to a lot of viewers, the golden age of TV was just, you know, shows being good and well-written, but being very traditional still. And, you know, broadcast entertainment has always been a commodity, but the trend now among rights and IP holders is that TV shows are specifically a commodity. They're all part of a product line that connects to feature films and other TV shows and other media and merchandise, and in some cases, theme parks. And so I wonder if, you know, TV holding up the banner of the auteur, or at least the long form storytelling, if that will be frustrated by the continual consolidation and brandification of TV properties, and it will see films kind of once again take the banner forward in terms of just sort of original, challenging, you know, morally ambiguous content. And not the kind of sanitized stuff that we get off of your Disney Plus or your corporate streamer.
Yeah, it is. Like, I mean, that's the thing I find really, really interesting. Again, this ties back to that thing that myself and Nick were talking about in terms of like the writers who you hire to make these shows. Where like, and again, Star Trek, because this is a Star Trek podcast, it's worth kind of just flagging this outright. Like, the Star Trek return to streaming kind of originated in a way that initially seemed very auteur driven. Like, I mean, the big announcement with Star Trek Discovery wasn't just that it was Star Trek Discovery and it was going to star Michelle Yeoh or whatever. It was also that it was going to be like produced and showrun by Brian Fuller, who was not only like a Star Trek veteran, which is, you know, nice. Somebody who has actually like worked on the franchise in a capacity where you can go back and you can see their understanding of it. And I would argue like Fuller's work on Voyager is about as good as the work of somebody who joined the franchise in Voyager could be, Darren says, trying to be diplomatic. But I honestly do think Fuller's work is generally good. I mean, there are blots like, say, Retrospect, for example, which I think even Fuller himself will go back and say, not don't want that one on my tombstone. But things like Mortal Coil, for example, I think he wrote like Bride of Chaotica and things like that. Like Fuller's...
Yeah, or his episode where Tom gets possessed by Christine.
Drive, was it? Yeah, did he do Drive? Yeah. Was that him?
He might have done Drive, but in
Alice. Sorry, and it's a one word title. Sorry,
he's taken his talents to the big screen now with the remake of Christine. If we see that,
if that actually happens, that's the thing with the Fuller project. It's like somewhere in a 25% chance of it happening. But like again, after that, he'd had a steady body of work. He'd done things like Wonderfuls, Pushing Daisies, Hannibal, which is like Hannibal is one of like my golden TV shows. Not just because it's
a perfect example of a quote unquote failure that has a strong love among the fan base.
That's the thing. It's not just like it's a great TV show, it's also just a crowning accomplishment in terms of this aired on like NBC on Thursday nights for 3 years now, admittedly, because the distribution deal meant that I think NBC somehow made money from its mere existence rather than having to like pay for it, which is unusual. I think there was some sort of weird arrangement with the De Laurentiis and kind of like the European distributors and stuff like that, where like NBC seemed to almost get paid to produce it, which seems like a very strange way, which explains how it got three seasons. But yeah, Fuller's brought in and it's like, this is great. He's going to come back to Star Trek. He's going to have like a cool vision. And I think he's talked a little bit about what his vision was. He wanted to be an anthology show that would jump forward through time. Like everybody I think has heard stories or rumors from people who know people who know people about like some of those ideas. Yeah. And you're like, those are, well, first of all, they're audacious, but also they're kind of amazing and I'd love to see them. And then
the tales grow in the telling.
That's
who's
it exactly.
To say if they're,
Well, I mean, part of me is like, it's kind of like, again, to bring back J.J. Abrams and Star Trek Into Darkness, it's kind of like when you hear about Colin Trevorrow's like plans for his Duel of the Fates, where it's like, having seen The Rise of Skywalker, you're immediately predisposed to go, well, anything would be better.
Sure.
And on paper, the concepts here are interesting, I guess. But then on the other hand, you kind of weigh it against, yes, but I've also seen Colin Trevorrow make a blockbuster.
Poor Colin forced to make these billion-dollar movies. I loved his quote the other day. He has a quote the other day where he said that Jurassic Park is inherently unfranchisable, he said without smiling, and then went to the bank to cash his huge check. But
but I'm gonna do it anyway. I think he may actually have said out loud. Like, that's the thing about that quote. I can't remember exactly what it was, but there's a sense of, it's undoable, but we're going to do it anyway. Ka-ching.
So somehow circling kind of back to what we're supposed to be talking about, is then the perfect auteur for the modern blockbuster, an auteur like J.J. Abrams, somebody who can bring you some sizzle, but not really say all that much? I mean, is that sort of the perfect target for some of these big properties?
Yeah, like that is a, like, again, and this gets back to like a bigger issue. I'm sorry, I love that Darren, you're kinda like, let's get to the point. And Darren's
we're all trying. We all keep grabbing the wheel.
We do. It's like, but Darren's like, no, let's scale back a bit. But I do think you raise a very interesting point there about like the question of authorship and auteur and like the auteur theory as applies to Abrahams. And this is the thing which is fascinating to me, which is in the 70s, you know, obviously the movie brats kind of came up and the new Hollywood movement, all this sort of stuff. They were all huge nerds who had like huge affection for the movies and the subject material that they grew up with. They're all big like John Ford, Alfred Hitchcock fans, all that sort of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And like all of their films are like heavily, heavily influenced by it. I mean, like, you know, you look at Spielberg's films and like War Horse is a John Ford fan film, basically, at some level. And obviously, like the idea that Lucas, when he made Star Wars, was like stealing from like Kurosawa and all these like World War II movies that he loved. But what's interesting is that it used to be you would take those references and you would build them into something new that was effectively an homage to these things. I think like Scott Mendelson at Forbes, who's very good at this sort of stuff, makes the argument that the rip-off, not remake school of filmmaking, which is like, you see a movie that you like, and you make your movie, which is kind of like it, but which is also your movie through and through, where it's like Spielberg, instead of just like remaking a screwball comedy, makes 1941. Scorsese, instead of just remaking an MGM musical, makes New York, New York. By the way, these are all terrible examples because they bombed, but you get what
I'm saying.
Good.
Yeah.
Like the result, they're not like what Hollywood should be trying to do, but you get what I'm saying. You have like De Palma, instead of like just remaking Vertigo or Psycho, goes and does like all the stuff that every De Palma movie ever, basically.
Yeah. Or anything that Tarantino does, too.
Yeah, Tarantino is a fantastic example of that as well, where you synthesize these references and you make something that is still distinctly your own while paying homage to them. And I think as Hollywood has gotten increasingly like blockbuster driven and increasingly franchise driven and increasingly, you know, recognizable IP driven, which again is all just a net result of the idea of like summer tentpoles colonizing the movie landscape, where you know, around about like 97, I think, is the year that people kind of put a like a pin in the map and go, 97 is the year where the studios realize that if you don't have an opening weekend, you are doomed. You will be very unlikely to leg it out. Ironically enough, that's the same year that gives you Titanic, which is the big counter argument to that. But generally speaking, in 97, you have this huge saturated like summer of movies where it's like, if these movies don't basically make, you know, half to 75% of their budget back in the opening weekend, it's dead. There's no point in even trying. You're never going to
come
get
on, Batman and Robin. Yeah. Come on.
That's it. Like, Warner's worst summer ever. It's like, well, don't worry. Conspiracy Theory will get us out of here. And if Conspiracy Theory won't, what about Steel? Everybody's rooting for Steel, right?
Yeah, right. There's always Contact.
Contact is, I'm amazed that Contact exists. Contact is like,
Like,
it's one of those movies that would never exist.
It's
today.
Zemeckis.
Yeah. It would never exist today. Can you imagine going to a studio and going, I want to make like a $90 million movie about alien contact? They're like, yeah, do the ships invade? Are there dogfights? Like, no.
What do the aliens look like?
Yeah. Mostly people have conversations in rooms that have computers in them. It's like,
the aliens look like David Morse. I hope that's okay. Yeah.
The kids love David Morse, right?
Sure.
But like you have like in 97 the point where it's like, okay, we need opening weekend or bust. So that's when you start seeing studios going, okay, well, if that's the case, then we need to get them in the door quickly. What gets people in the door quickly is what they already know. Names they already recognize, brands they're already familiar with. So you start seeing this lean into IP. So you're suddenly hiring directors, not just to make their versions of things that they loved as kids, but to make their versions of the literal things that they loved as kids. So you have like this interesting contrast where like there are dozens of directors. Like, I mean, it's really easy to like compare directors to Spielberg. Spielberg is like the towering American director. He's synonymous with the term American director. But like Abrams, what distinguishes Abrams from a pack of imitators, and I mean, look, you can point to people like, say, Jeff Nichols, for example. You can point to people like later on, like Jordan Peele. But Abrams is different because Abrams isn't just trying to make his own movies or his own projects. He's quite happy to just slot in and apply his own affection for Spielberg or Lucas-esque filmmaking. And I'd argue it's more Spielberg influence than Lucas influence filmmaking, but to apply it to any project whatsoever. And again, like, you hear all these stories about Abrams kind of like just hanging around Hollywood for decades, being the guy. Like, I think he worked on the early iterations of Shrek. He was somehow involved in like the CGI in the very early iterations of Shrek, as I recall.
Weird.
That's how long he's been kind of just bouncing around and kind of working his way into the industry. And like, I think that why Abrams becomes this guy for the studios, where it's like, okay, we're rebooting Star Trek, we need Abrams to do it, or we're bringing back Star Trek, Star Wars, and we need Abrams to do it, is because he's a guy who will take notes. And I mean, I don't mean this in a disparaging way. I'm actually reasonably fond of Abrams with all the qualifications I'm about to offer. But Abrams never seems like a guy who's ever going to go to a studio, look, my cut or I walk. It's like my call or I walk. You either trust me or I don't. This is what my movie is. This is what it's going to be. Abrams always strikes me as the kind of guy who's like, well, look, here's the situation we're in. Here's what we got to do to get out of it. Let's roll up our sleeves and let's try to avoid any controversy along the way, any misgivings along the way. Here's what you want. Here's what interests me. Here's how I can make it happen. Let's do this thing. Which I think is kind of like, it's commendable in its own way, but it runs aground when you hit something like Rise of Skywalker, where what the studio wants from that movie is fundamentally unachievable, is probably the best way to describe it.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, that, you know, when people think of J.J. Abrams, you know, they think of him being this media mogul. And obviously he has, you know, a lot of work on TV. He's the producer of a lot of films and TV. But he's only directed 6 features.
Yeah.
And only one of those was a non-franchise feature. So when I think of J.J. Abrams, I have a trouble thinking of his style. Like, who is he as a director other than just, like you said, kind of... Spielberg influenced. And in this modern age, like, you know, he is established clearly as, I don't want to call him a player in the, like, the Robert Altman sense, but he's definitely a guy who is, like you said, around Hollywood. You know, he sold a couple films, he'd been producing for a while, he'd even acted and appeared in a couple films. And so now he's just sort of like the mogul who's going to make your nerd movie happen. But in this modern age, he is constantly being interviewed. He's constantly, you know, showing up for talks or doing SNL sketches. And so he is a personality as well. And as a person who, as you've identified, is somebody who's like, I am J.J. Abrams, but I don't have like an agenda or like an artistic vision, not to denigrate him and say that he doesn't have an artistic vision, but he doesn't have like a forceful vision. He should be like the least interesting person to interview, right? It's interesting to interview a Nick Pizzolatto and you're not going to know if he's going to throw a chair at you or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, he is kind of, without being seen as it, like, he is kind of what Lucas could have been if he had stuck around, you know, been the sort of sci-fi grandpa to everybody instead of just sort of being bitter and hanging out at the ranch for the rest of his time. So it's weird that, like, he's definitely been influential, certainly, but I'm surprised that he has not done and accomplished more as somebody that is on everybody's lips all the time.
I don't think he wants to. I don't think Abrams is kind of like missing out or feels like he's not accomplished anything. Like, this is the thing, and this is going to sound really dismissive, I think, and this is talking about a director who I think is better than Abrams, to be clear, but it's like James Gunn. And I remember having a conversation with an Irish film critic having come out of The Suicide Squad, which I loved. It was one of my favorite movies of last year.
I should
be very clear. Definite article, if you will. But we were talking about like the way in which the franchise machine in Hollywood inevitably like snatches up young directors, young promising directors. And it's like, here, make your franchise film. And while you're there, let's take off anything that vaguely resembles your style. Like, I mean, you know, you talk about like Black Widow directed by Kate Shortland, for example, but I couldn't tell you that was directed by Kate Shortland. I say as somebody who liked Is It Berlin Syndrome, the film she made directly beforehand. Something like, I loved, you know, Daniel Destin-Cretton's kind of like, was it, not Short Term, I did like Short Term 12, but he also did the recent one, Just Mercy, the one with Michael B. Jordan, and obviously Brie Larson as well. I really liked that movie as well. It's a clever update of the death row dramas of the 90s. And I was like, this is a director with a very clear social conscience who has things he wants to say. And I go and see like Shang-Chi and The Legend of the Ten Rings, and I'm like, that's any other Marvel movie, you know? And I think to Gunn's credit, Gunn is a director who, when he makes these things and they're very much his own, they're all preoccupied with his own particular themes, his own particular ideas, things that fascinate him, ideas that he keeps coming back to, stylistic quirks that he has, all that sort of stuff. They're recognizably James Gunn movies. But talking about his work with another Irish critic coming out of The Suicide Squad, I was like, I don't feel like I'm losing anything by the fact that Gunn is constantly making these big budget superhero blockbusters. I feel like he's living his best life. He's enjoying himself. He's doing what interests him. But I also don't feel like I'm missing out on James Gunn's Just Mercy or James Gunn's Berlin Syndrome or, you know, any of those, you know, James Gunn's Oppenheimer or whatever the equivalent would be. I feel like he's perfectly where he is, doing the things that he loves doing, having a good time doing it, and making them to a higher standard than many of his contemporaries. It's the ultimate win-win situation. And I think, like, with Abrams, and again, I always have to put the asterisks here, like, with The Rise of Skywalker, which, cards on the table, possibly the worst blockbuster of the decade, and there's a lot of competition for that, I would, you know, at the risk of a hot take. But, like, with Abrams, I do get a sense that, like, what he's doing now is kind of what he wants to do. I don't feel like we're missing any deeply intimate or personal work. Like, even you mentioned the one original film that he's directed, which is Super 8, which is a movie that I really like as well. I find it incredibly charming and sweet and moving. But that's a Steven Spielberg fan film.
I'm not sure people know that it's not directed by Steven Spielberg if they don't read the fine print.
Yeah. Like, that's like right down to the lens flare in it as well, and the way in which like it shoots night and stuff. Like, it's weird that it's like Super 8 is kind of weirdly like J.J. Abrams' Roma, in that it's another, or you know, the Empire, Sam Mendes' Empire of Light, or is it The Hand of God? Was it Almodovar? Who was The Hand of God recently? Kind of gone out of my head, but you know, the wave of movies, or like the Apollo 10 and a half recently as well, Linklater's movie, all these movies about young directors talking about how cinema moved and affected them, and how like they made the choices that they made as a result of like being heavily influenced by this stuff. And you know, obviously Spielberg's making The Fablemans as like the ultimate kind of like crowning moment of that, but it's weird that like Super 8 is J.J. Abrams' like very early entry in the genre. But it doesn't even feel oddly personal, this movie about kids falling in love with movies and making movies. It feels very much like a fan film for the kind of person who actually had that experience, who was Steven Spielberg. And I say that like as somebody who really likes Super 8. I find it an immensely charming film. I would wholeheartedly recommend it. It's a wonderful evening. But it's like, I don't feel like this is a profound artistic statement. I just feel like Abrams was like, Spielberg did this and it seemed fun and this is a good cast. And, you know, I mean, everyone likes Kyle Chandler, right? Why not? And I'm like, why not? I don't feel like I'm missing anything from Abrams' lack of authorship. I don't feel like Hollywood's losing anything by having him make these movies. This feels like the worst like backhanded compliment I'm making. Hollywood's losing anything by having him make these movies.
Well, you know, but you're making a good point, though, talking of The Fablemans. I just can't wait to see David Lynch play John Ford. But in terms of what you're describing of James Gunn, like, we're talking about him like he's got some terminal disease, but he's, you know, he's living his best life, you know, he's owning it. And what he's doing is he's getting to make the kind of films that he would love to make, and he's putting his personal stamp on them. And we used to call that John Carpenter. We used to call that James Cameron. It used to be that was a person who was breathing life into a movie that could just be, you know, I Come in Peace or something like that. But instead, it's Terminator 2, or it's a genre film that is original and catching people's imaginations. And now those, you know, genre films are all IPs that are definitely probably Predator films. And so they're owned by a studio, and the studio is making very careful decisions about who it is that they want to take on this important project. And so you don't have the same, I don't know if it was the Wild West exactly, but you don't have the same sort of creative chaos that you had, you know, in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, I mean, like, again, part of me is like, I don't want to like over pathologize this, and I don't want to claim that I have answers that I don't have. But part of me is like, you look at the emergence of the algorithm as like a guiding force, and like Barry, the recent third season of Barry, like, does a fantastic job of the algorithm, where like there's a show on that show that gets canceled, I believe, 12 hours after it premieres because the algorithm predicts that it won't succeed. But like, the idea is that, you know, now you have all these data points that are gathered from, again, from the fact that, you know, when you're streaming, you're watching it on a digital service, that click is logged. It can tell how much of it you watch. It can tell how frequently you watch. It can tell how quickly you watch. It can tell whether you skip over any of it, whether you go back for it, you know, what you watch on your TV, what you watch on your phone, all this sort of like, you know, metadata information that tells you more about what audiences are consuming and how they're consuming it. That stuff didn't exist in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. All you had were box office receipts, and those were wild. So you had no idea what was actually going to succeed or land with audiences. So for a studio, it was just like, pick some people you trust and like give them complete creative freedom. Like, you know, this Spielberg kid makes movies that make money. I don't know what it is about those movies that audiences are responding to, but just give him more money and have him make what he wants to make, and we trust the people will turn out. Whereas now it's like, no, we know that people like the two words Star Trek, or we know that they like the two words Star Wars, and we know that if we're making a Star Wars, there has to be a fight sequence 10 minutes in. Like, I mean, there's the horrible, well, I say horrible, the fascinating and terrifying Kerry Joji Fukunaga interview where he's talking about Maniac, and he's like, he's talking about how things as simple as Netflix coming and telling you, like, what background, what color you should make the background of a set in order to keep viewers watching longer. And it's like, yeah. As a creator, you really have no response to that. Because you can't go, no, I think it should be red. Because they'll come back and say, no, well, actually, the statistics show that if it's green, you'll manage to hold on to a full 4% more of the audience for 5 minutes longer.
Well, you got that note. There's plenty of green in Maniac.
Yeah, like that. That's the thing. Like, that's one of the factors that I imagine is kind of playing into this, where it's like, instead of hiring people and kind of trusting them to make their movies and counting on those movies to make money, it's just like, no, we've decided the movies we're going to make that are going to make money, and we want to give them to people who we trust are not going to pull a Josh Trank on us, you know?
Yeah. And I wonder if the algorithm is behind some of the decisions that are causing upheaval in Hollywood currently with... Warner Brothers just torching their entire model, or NBC considering eliminating the 10 o'clock hour of programming. All of these Star Trek films disappearing from Paramount Plus.
Yeah, that's insane.
Not sure what's going on with that.
I mean, luckily, last week's episode, this week's episode, next week's episode are still on there for listeners who can watch along.
I think Beyond's on Fubo if you want to check out Star Trek Beyond.
Fubo? What is Fubo?
Yeah, right. I know, yeah. Oh. So, things like that, dropping Batgirl from their schedule. As a write-off. It's just, it's bewildering. I mean, Hollywood has always made weird decisions, but adding a new decision maker, a new decider in the form of the AI bot 3000 or whatever it is a little bit chilling artistically.
And not just artistically, but the fact is, like, the algorithm is only based off decisions audiences have already made. The algorithm, by definition, cannot factor what audiences might like or will like in the future. It's all about what they liked in the past, which, again, is one of the reasons why everything is so nostalgic now, all these franchise reboots. Because it's like, instead of saying, well, no, they liked a, you know, Steven Spielberg movie, so they'll like another Steven Spielberg movie. It's like, no, they like Star Trek, so let's just do another Star Trek.
Right. Yeah. And you know the trend of AI art that's going on right now, where you put something in and it makes it. That's the only explanation I can think of for Netflix's Blonde. Somebody made a movie version of that and just fed a bunch of Marilyn Monroe pictures into that and just said, give us a movie.
The Blonde is a very interesting movie that we do not have time to discuss.
No, we don't at all. Instead, let's discuss the film that we're here to discuss. Because when I got in touch with you and I told you that we were talking about the films of Star Trek on the show, you suggested Star Trek Into Darkness. You said you had a fondness for it and that it represented an interesting moment in culture, a moment that we've been talking about and we'll continue to talk about. But I feel like this is, and we've just been talking about this, but I think this is the first Trek film of the terminally online generation.
Yeah.
We had the internet in 2009, but I think that it explains the stark contrast that you see in people's reactions to it. I mean, there were naysayers, diehards in 2009 who refused that film, but I think people were willing to give the film latitude and they recognized the energy and the craft with which it was made. But when Into Darkness comes out, you know, it's generally praised by critics and audiences, but there's almost an immediate and persistent backlash to it. And it doesn't, at least in most forms, bear the usual marks of internet trollery that we see, like sexism and racism. But there is a duck-like quality in terms of walking like a duck and quacking like a duck to people's response to it, not being good.
I wouldn't go that far. I'd be hesitant to kind of like jump in on it in those terms. But I do think there are a couple of things to note in particular about the reaction to it. I think your intro was very, very good in terms of like laying the scene and kind of laying out how to talk about Star Trek Into Darkness. Because it is worth flagging that this movie, when it opened to critical raves. Critics absolutely adored this when it opened. The reaction from general audiences seemed to be ecstatic. I think unadjusted for inflation is the obligatory comment here, but isn't it still the highest grossing Star Trek movie?
Highest grossing total, Star Trek 2009, highest grossing domestically, but total,
And I mean, what's interesting about this is you can literally like trace the moment that like the audience turned on Star Trek Into Darkness, right? Like right down to the month, which is August. So it opens in May. And it premieres on, again, I do a podcast on the IMDb, so this sort of nerdy stuff really interests me. But it immediately jumps onto the IMDb 250, which again suggests a warm reaction to it. It gets an A cinema score from audiences as well, which suggests a warm reaction to it. It's at number 158 on the 250. And then, like, it kind of, you know, it hangs around on the 250 until August. And then from the 20th of August through to the 27th of August is all it takes for it to drop completely off the radar. And you also then have the very high profile Star Trek convention where it's voted the worst Star Trek movie ever made. Only a couple of months after its release. And look, taste is subjective. People like what they like. I'm not going to judge people here. And I am a massive Star Trek fan who finds like things to love in every one of these franchise movies. But part of me is also like, if you watched Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, and Star Trek Nemesis, and Star Trek Into Darkness, and you thought Star Trek Into Darkness was unequivocally the worst of those movies.
Out of all of those,
I would maybe question the metrics that you are using to gauge that. I would maybe wonder what it is specifically about it that you are reacting against in making that judgment. And I mean, again, this is the situation where I don't think this is a backlash that is based in any of the stuff that we talked about, like all the reasons that we are suspicious about fan backlashes today when they happen to things like, say, the Star Wars sequels, when they happen to Rings of Power, you know, Captain Marvel, Black Panther. Maybe there's a pattern emerging here. I don't know what it is. I don't think that applies here. But what I do think, and I mentioned kind of like this being a moment in culture that's worth talking about, is that this is kind of the moment where, and I use this term with a great deal of affection, I consider myself a nerd, but this is the moment where the nerds inherited the Earth, where this is out a year after The Avengers is the highest grossing movie of 2012. It's the moment where the Marvel Cinematic Universe is like unequivocally and undeniably the biggest franchise on the face of the planet. Comic book movies are now completely booming. I would argue like 2011 is a watershed moment for comic book movies because it's the point where you start getting, you know, reboots. I think X-Men First Class is that year, where you start seeing like terrible movies coming out. You start seeing like non-brand, like non-Marvel, non-DC ones like Green Hornet kind of like just squeezing in because somebody has to wring some milk out of this somehow. You start seeing this push towards shared universes, where, like, I mean, Man of Steel is another 2013 release as well, which is again comparable in terms of urban devastation, which I'm sure we'll come back to. But you also, like, with that shift, with the understanding that the Marvel Cinematic Universe is now the biggest brand on the planet, comic book movies are now the biggest movies on the planet, where you're starting to see franchise kind of reboots just kind of creep back into the mainstream. The year before this, you had Spider-Man, The Amazing Spider-Man, which to that point was seen as an obscenely quick reboot, but nowadays seems like they waited 5 years. That was very restrained of them.
Oh, 5 years.
Whole 5 years. but in 2013, you have two big controversies, which are very interesting to me, and I think are kind of interconnected. One of them is the Into Darkness backlash or response, or kind of like, as you said, the whiplash response that it generates, which I think is very rooted in fandom and fans and the question of who this movie belongs to and who this movie is for. And you have a similar reaction happen to Iron Man 3, where Iron Man 3 is, you know, I would argue one of the better movies in the MCU, but it is a movie that is unabashedly an auteurist kind of movie. It's arguably one of the last great MCU auteurist movies. It's a Shane Black movie through and through. And it's more a Shane Black movie, I would argue, than it is an Iron Man movie or an MCU movie. And that movie is released. It has a hell of a twist in it. I'm going to assume people have already seen it. If you haven't, press pause right now, watch all of Iron Man 3, then come back and join me. But okay, jump 30 seconds or a minute forward in this, because this will be quick, where it's revealed that the Mandarin, who was promised in the movie, is in fact an actor and a creation of the US military industrial complex. And it basically plays as a deconstruction of the idea of the Mandarin as a comic book villain, exploring the ways in which when you were publishing comics in the 60s, it was probably convenient to create these racial caricatures that could serve as convenient enemies for the military industrial complex in the way that, say, terrorists do today. And I think that is a brilliant piece of social commentary that has a lot to say about the war on terror, pop culture, and the intersection between pop culture and, again, the American military self-image. But a lot of fans were like, yeah, but he doesn't have 10 rings and he's not a magic, you know, man from China. Yeah, so this is a gross insult. Like, you have the article that's published, and it's one of those things. I think it's I shouldn't name him. I'm not going to name him. It's one of those articles that's I would point to as a moment where there was a seismic shift in nerd culture, where Cinema Blend publishes a headline, "Iron Man 3 ruined the Mandarin and real fans should be pissed." And this is from the guy who would go on to deliver, I don't understand turning red because I'm a man, therefore the movie's bad.
Yeah.
And that's a moment where it really feels like for the first time, audiences online, you mentioned it's the first kind of terminally online movie, but it feels like it's the first time that audiences online who are comprised entirely of fans start to realize that like fandom on the internet is an identity. And that fandom on the internet as an identity can be harnessed in a way that creates in-groups and out-groups. And that the fan in-group is a group that deserves or needs to be served as a priority. Where I would argue, and I may be being unfair here, and I apologize if I am. Listeners, I apologize if I'm generalizing here. But a lot of the reaction against Into Darkness that I saw was not from general audiences, and you know, we'll talk, I have very particular memories of how I saw this movie, who I saw it with, and what that meant to that person, but it felt like it was very much a fan ownership thing, where it was like, this is not Star Trek, this is not what Star Trek should be, this is an insult to the fans of Star Trek, this is offending the fans of Star Trek, this is taking something that is special and sacred, and like, we... cat's out of the bag, it's no longer 2013. It very much rips wholesale entire plot points, beats, character arcs from The Wrath of Khan and just shoehorns them into a modern franchise blockbuster. And a lot of the reaction against the movie is very much, you know, in the camp of, well, they despoiled this thing that was once special and beautiful and magical. And they're kind of like, that's an insult to fans. That's an insult to what a Star Trek fan is or should be. And I kind of... That's where I would draw the connection between the backlash to Iron Man 3 and Into Darkness, and then kind of through into, say, the Star Wars sequels and into obviously later stuff as well, where that stuff becomes twisted and you start seeing more bad actors kind of latch themselves onto it. Because it's worth, there are certain places where I cannot mention this word, so feel free to edit it if you want. But like Gamergate is, I think, a year away at this point as well. So that's the point where you start seeing political actors realize that they can use these fandom gripes and kind of weaponize them and kind of get young men in particular on the internet angry at the idea that they, whoever they are coming for your media for things that used to belong to you. And they're trying to make it so that it's now going to other people. It's a really weird... Oh my God, I can't actually believe I made this connection, and I apologize, this is not a politics podcast, but it is a very literal expression of well, it is now, says Darren, just going all in. but it's that thing where, like, remember before, like, woke and before SJW were like the go-to words, it was like cultural Marxism was like the go-to scare quotes word.
Is it still around?
Okay, cool. This is how horrible the past couple of years have been. It's like I blocked that particular nightmare out, but like, cultural Marxism in some ways kind of like feels like it embodies a lot of the resentment that those political movements tap into when they try to wade into cultural spaces, where the idea is that they are taking something. It's a redistribution of culture. It's a redistribution of pop culture, where it's like they're taking this thing that once belonged to you specifically and they're sharing it with everybody else, and therefore they're diluting its value. And therefore you, as somebody who like is a true owner and stakeholder in this, should feel wronged. Yeah, sorry. I don't know how, if this is fair or unfair, feel free to cut all of this, but that is kind of like something that I find kind of interesting here, because like my memory of Star Trek and Star Trek Into Darkness is largely tied to the fact that I saw them with people who were not Star Trek fans, in inverted commas, who didn't consider themselves to be hardcore fans of the franchise. And they went and they loved it. And in particular, my partner at the time, who was not a Trekkie by any way, shape or form, like went to see those movies and kind of fell in love with them. Like we left the original Star Trek and again, like I'd always loved Star Trek. It was never a source of tension. It wasn't like they were like, ugh, Star Trek or anything like that. But it was just like, it was always an interest I had and they didn't necessarily share, which is fine. Everybody has interests in relationships that they share or don't. But after we left Star Trek, they were like, so Spock's hot, right? And I'm like, yeah, Spock's hot. And it's like, so you know how you've watched all of Star Trek? Are there other examples of Spock being hot? And I'm like, let me tell you, there are plenty of examples of Spock being hot and emotional. And I remember as a result of the 2009 Star Trek, getting to watch like The Naked Now or like A Mock sure. Time with my yeah. partner, and like having a really good time and getting to share something that, you know, wasn't, you know, getting to share that with somebody who didn't consider it to be their thing, didn't consider it to be something they were interested in, and just finding real joy in that. And I remember going to see Into Darkness, and we'll talk about this like when we talk about maybe like the Cannes of it, the Wrath of Khan kind of aspect of it, and like fan service gone wrong and all that sort of stuff. But my abiding memory of it, and I think one of the tensions over discussions about it, is that there's a tendency to think that because it is ripping off, let's be frank, Star Trek The Wrath of Khan, that yeah. it is doing fan service or is pandering to fans. And that's not what it's doing at all, because like fans don't want you to remake The Wrath of Khan. They want you to acknowledge how great it is. They want you to make a show that tells you how great it was, that kind of traps it in amber and celebrates like its accomplishments and how brilliant it is. But they don't yeah. want you to go back and revisit it. They don't want you to take it out of the original packaging, as it were. Whereas when I was watching this with my partner at the time, who, again, not seen Star Trek II The Wrath of Khan, not even seen Space Seed, because apparently Spock is not hot in Space Seed. But I know that's a hot take. But we were sitting down, we were talking, we were watching the movie, and like at the moment where Benedict Cumberbatch says, "My name is Khan," which you could argue does not make sense, and my brain was working through the many ways that that didn't make sense, but like my partner like nudges me, like punches me gently like in the upper arm, like grin on their face, leans in, points to the screen with all the pride of a proud parent and says, "That's Khan." Because in their experience, like, Khan is this big thing in Star Trek. It's this, you know, one of the movies is named after him. One of the most mimetic quotes from the Star Trek franchise like, you know, Kirk like screaming into the microphone, pure William Shatner, eyes bulging out of his skull, going, "Khan, Khan, Khan."
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so getting to see the character called Khan on screen, having no idea who he was, what he represented, what the character's backstory was, to my partner at the time, that felt like they were being invited into a party. It felt like they yeah. were being like made welcome, where it's like, here's this thing that true Star Trek fans know and love and consider important to the franchise, and here it is being presented to you as in a way that makes you feel like you are part of it. Like, now you, audience member, have had your Khan-shaped experience. And I will always kind of love it for that. Like, I will always have a great deal of affection for Into Darkness for that, because it really did. And again, it wasn't just my partner, it was the entire cinema. And look, I know this is reductive, and I know this is, you know, maybe bad form or whatever, but there is the kind of, and to be honest, there are better ways that they could have framed this, but like one of the things that Abrams kind of came back to in interviews around Star Trek and Star Trek Into Darkness was that he and the creative team wanted to make a Star Trek movie that they could take their wives to. Now, maybe you should have phrased that a bit differently, but I understand the sentiment behind it, which is
yeah.
everybody who is a Star Trek fan has people in their lives who are not Star Trek fans. And yeah. This is something that it confuses me about, like, the way that people talk about pop culture in general. It's something I've never understood. I've always kind of grappled with, which is the idea that, like, I like to share the things that I like. I like to share them with people who don't like those things and maybe find a way in. And it works both ways as well. I like when people find things that I didn't think that I'd like and welcome me into them. I like it yeah. when, you know, I'm made to feel welcome in places that I didn't think I belonged. And I think that, like, the two Abrams Star Trek movies in particular are very, very good at doing that. Like, they are pure crowd-pleasing kind of blockbusters, like, made in the Spielberg fashion. And, again, not the time or place for this, but it's worth arguing that the Star Trek franchise had kind of been trying to do this for, you know, quite a while leading up to this. I think Nemesis is very much trying to be that kind of crowd-pleasing blockbuster, just very, very, very badly. But you could argue, even say First Contact is an example of it done very well as well, where that's a movie that's like, it's a zombie movie and it's a time travel comedy. Get on board with it. Even things like, you look at, say, Voyager under Brannon Braga, where Voyager is like at the cutting edge of, like, at the cutting edge in the late 90s of, like, CGI technology, but where it's like, what if Star Trek could be spectacle driven, where you have, like, big two-parters, like, you have, you know, obviously you have, like, Future's End and kind of Scorpion and stuff like that, which are big bombastic two-parters, but, like, in the fourth season you have, like, The Killing Game airs as a TV movie where they air part one and part two on the same night. Then in season five, like, Dark Frontier actually airs as a TV movie with no divide between the two episodes. Then I think you have as a Flesh and Blood in the seventh season does the same thing. But even standalone episodes like, say, Dragon's Teeth with those horrible CGI corridor effects, but like 30 Days, where like a huge pitch of that is like, well, now we can render like underwater physics in CGI. Isn't it amazing? The Species 8472 as like the first CGI Star Trek alien, or even Timeless, when you watch that, it's very much like, let's do a blockbuster on a TV budget, where it feels like Star Trek has been pushing to do this populist blockbuster thing for years and years and years before Abrams kind of cracks it. So, like, I would argue that, like, Star Trek and Into Darkness are, like, a culmination of something the franchise had been trying to do for a while, and something that I think was kind of important to the franchise's future. Because I think, like, if a franchise is going to survive, it needs to attract new fans. It needs to open itself up. It can't keep serving the same audiences over and over again. And we mentioned kind of comic books a couple of times here, where comic books have that problem where the demographics buying them are, you know, getting older and kind of aging out, or, you know, dying, unfortunately. And it's having difficulty attracting younger readers to kind of keep it refreshed and renewed and reinvigorated. And I think that, like, one of... at the risk of being, again, controversial on this very controversial episode, apparently, we're doing. But I think you can tell that, like, when you went from Star Trek in the 60s to The Next Generation, right? You obviously, you had the diehard 60s Star Trek fans who were like, why is the captain bald now? And why are they spending so much time in the meeting room and all this sort of stuff? Like, where's Spock? Where's Kirk? Why isn't Picard beating more people with his fists? But The Next Generation kind of, like, grew its audience and found its own audience. And it's very telling, I think, that a lot of the Star Trek fandom is still rooted in the Next Generation. Like, and I say that as somebody who is rooted in the Next Generation.
Yeah,
I say that as somebody who, for me, growing up, Star Trek was the Next Generation. But it's kind of interesting that so much of the idea of who a Star Trek fan is, well, you had to have loved Star Trek specifically between, like, 1989 and, like, 1994, or maybe stretch it to 1999.
Right.
And it's like, that is what Star Trek was, is, and ever shall be. And I find myself kind of wary of that, because it's like, no, you need to expand. You need to kind of cast the net open. And I always feel heartened, because there are, you know, you encounter it on the internet in the wild, however wild the algorithm is. But you'll always see people. I went on, I did a search for Into Darkness just to do like a temperature check of it. And I was surprised to find that there are a lot of younger fans who, for them, you know, Star Trek and Into Darkness were their gateway to Star Trek. It was like what made them love the franchise and what brought them to the CBS treks. And I'm kind of like, I kind of like that. I think there's value in that.
Yeah, I think there definitely is. I'm still reeling from you introducing the idea of nerd wealth distribution.
I'm sorry about that.
Redistributing nerd wealth. That's incredible.
Incredible in so many ways. It's like awe-inspiring in the biblical
let's
sense.
Let's get it done. Let's do it now. Yeah. Vote this November. It seems to be such a fine line, too, because you get something like these films, which were, you know, accepted by critics and most fans, that are kind of remixing what we know, these elements. But then you do something else, and people feel like they're being pandered to. And so you get something like... Or they're messing with something vital. So, like, Rogue One is essentially just, like, the prequel to, you know, the movie, up to the point where it literally ends 10 minutes before Star Wars begins. And everybody loves all the nostalgic ships and seeing all the guys in the weird, you know, teardrop helmets. But then you try to do something like Solo, and people are like, that's not Star Wars.
Yeah.
That's not my Han Solo.
It's hard to tell where the line is.
Which is it?
What is the line there? Well, I mean, I would argue the difference there is, and again, not to go back to the cliche of the argument we've already had, but like, it's vision, where it's like you watch Rogue One, and that is a product, somebody somewhere, whether it's Gareth Edwards or Tony Gilroy directing the final act. But like, that is a movie that has a viewpoint, whereas you look at Solo, and like, I have the greatest deal of respect for Ron Howard. Like, I mean, you know, like Jon Favreau, he seems like a guy, if you wanted to move, you could call him and he'd come up and help you. He seems like a lovely, lovely guy.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I have a huge soft spot for his really terrible Da Vinci Code, like, trilogy, where, like, they are, what if a James Bond movie, but for your granddad, where, like, there's a sequence where Tom Hanks is menaced by a drone in a public park, and it's like, this is the product of a 60-year-old man imagination. Like Ron Howard is sitting outside going, drones, public parks, they really get me. But like you look at Solo, and that's a movie that has had anything resembling a perspective kind of stripped out of it. And I mean to be fair, to give that movie credit, without wanting to seem mean about it, I will say that it looks much better than a movie that has its production history should look. Like the fact that it is at all internally coherent is a credit to everybody involved. The fact that it lacks any vision is like the smallest possible problem, considering all the issues with it, I would contend, considering all the like issues that it faced.
And on this non-political show, I also think it's interesting that two films that were in varying ways interfered with by the studio, one of them, Rogue One, has a message socially, if you can call it that, that is more general of fight the, you know, the Empire, be part of the rebellion and have hope. And Solo, I think in its initial conception, had a lot of progressive ideas in it. You know, there's a robot uprising in it. There's people despoiling, you know, a native planet and the natives rising up against that. And all, I don't know if it's just Disney going, it's a little too rough for a Star Wars movie. Let's strip all that content out and just give people a roller coaster ride.
Well, I mean, that does feel a little bit like, and again, to bring back the Abrams, but that does feel a lot like what the issues were with like Rise of Skywalker. Like, I honestly think one of the big problems with like live action Star Wars since December 2017, let's just say the three words, since The Last Jedi, is the idea that you know, these things don't have viewpoints, that they're like, that they're sanding these things off, where it's like the worst thing these shows or kind of movies can have is a perspective, and that perspective can either be a unique perspective on the franchise property, such as, you know, such as Rian Johnson being like, well, what is a Star Wars fan? What does it mean to be a fan of Star Wars and to have a relationship with this complicated text? Does it mean being blindly reverent, or does it mean finding yourself within it? And it's like, no. It means you buy Star Wars products. That's what it means. That's what being a Star Wars fan is. You pay a subscription. Or as you said, obviously political stuff, where like the Last Jedi is like, so sexting with Nazis? ?
What do you think?
Hot or not? The answer is not. But like, I mean, whereas like Rise of Skywalker is this thing that feels like it's so perfectly calibrated to avoid having any perspective whatsoever, where it gives you just enough on either side, where like it. Fans hated Rose Tico, fans in inverted commas, extremely loud people online hated Rose Tico and were like incredibly racist towards her. So it's like, okay, so we don't want to give them the satisfaction of not having Rose Tico in this movie. So she's going to be in the movie. It's like, okay, good. But we also don't want her to be too much in this movie. So if you could just give her like one or two scenes, it's like, okay. And it's like, okay, so loud people on the internet had a problem with Admiral Holdo. And it's like, So we're going to make reference to her. Yep, okay, that's grand. But we're only going to make reference to how she did a thing that we're not going to do this time. It's like, okay. It's like, okay, so, and then, you know the way how there's these fans who like Rey and Kylo? It's like, well, we're going to give them what they want. They're gonna have a moment together. It's like, okay. It's like, you know how there's also fans who don't like that. So what we're going to do is we're going to make sure that they don't get a good moment and they're separated at the end. It's like, okay.
And like, blurry background lesbian kiss, and that's it. Lights out.
That's it. Something we can cut from the Chinese market if we absolutely have to. It feels like every decision in that movie came through like a committee of 13 people who argued about it for 10 hours and then settled on like the kind of like King Solomon solution of just cut the baby in half. And nobody was like, no, take the baby. It was like, no, saw the baby, work through the baby.
And
we got 10 more babies.
If there's a lot, no, we have more babies to come. Yeah. Coming down the line. And as we established before, like, I'm not sure that J.J. Abrams was the guy that made those calls, but no. He was definitely the one who was comfortable putting them into effect.
Well, that's it. Like, I mean, again, this is the thing where I don't want to, like, defend Abrams too much, and I don't want to, like, you know, criticize him too much. But the press, the press tour for Rise of Skywalker is absolutely fascinating, because it sometimes feels like you can see his soul leaving his body, where he yeah. feels very, like, and again, it's, like, at the risk of, this is what a lot of modern filmmaking is. I know that we're talking about Into Darkness, but it reminds me of, like, Louis Leterrier on The Incredible Hulk, where, like, Leterrier's job on The Incredible Hulk was not to be the director, not to be the guy who has a vision that guides the movie. His job right. was to be chief negotiator between Edward Norton and Marvel Studios. And it really yeah. does feel like Abrams' role on The Rise of Skywalker was to be, like, chief negotiator between four or five different factions within Disney, where he's giving interviews, like, where he's saying, you know, the fans that hate Rise of Skywalker, they're right. The fans who love Rise of Skywalker, they're also right. You know?
yeah.
And, like, I did the best job I could. And it's like, that's a ringing endorsement, JJ. like, and it's like, part of me is like, I'm not nitpicking, because he seems exhausted and I'm exhausted and I didn't make the movie. I just watched the movie. So it's like, yeah. I don't fault him too much, but there is an element there where it's like, he's not getting out there and kind of punching or wrestling. He's not making a strong statement about, like, it's the Colin Trevorrow thing you mentioned, which is like, look,
yeah.
I don't know if this movie needs to exist, but hey, I got a house I got to pay for. So yeah, what you going to yeah. do?
And you got that in the aftermath to this film as well, as, yeah. as soon as that sort of turn came before. And I should just mention, like, we'll continue to talk, I guess, about the development of the film. If fans and listeners want to know more, there is a lot of information that you can find on the internet about this film.
Yeah.
We are way past the days where Leonard Nimoy says, oh, we did this with the whales, or we did that with the whales, or William Shatner talks about wanting to make love to the mountain. Like, there are hours and hours. Hours and hours of interviews and footage where they talk about what they wanted to do, what they didn't want to do. They contradict themselves. Yeah. You can totally turn yourself around. But as soon as that point hits a couple months later, where suddenly it seems like people are upset at the film, then suddenly all the mea culpas start.
Yeah.
And so every interview is like, sorry about that, guys. Or like, yeah, you know, we wanted to put somebody in strong like Khan, but then we didn't want to, like, redo it, but then we realized maybe we were, but at that point we were doing it anyway. And you've got Damon Lindelof apologizing for the Alice Eve underwear scene, and suddenly it's like, at that point, that's the online point where they realize, oh, the next interview isn't going to be me just telling set stories, like, now I'm gonna yeah. have to respond to, like, what people are saying on the internet,
and now we're gonna have to turn into the Swerve, as it were, because we don't want to alienate any of this online crowd. Like, that's the really weird thing about this, where it feels like the online reaction to this, and not just to this, but to movies in general, gets somewhat overblown, where it's like, and again, the Last Jedi is just an easy example to use here, where that movie is the highest grossing movie of its year. It is the biggest selling Blu-ray of the following year. It has an A yeah. cinema score. You know, it's well reviewed by critics. It's by all accounts, it is a massive, massive success, but there's a very vocal online backlash to it. So it feels like Disney has to respond to that. It's things like the firing of James Gunn, which is, like, masterminded by a few, like, very clever, very cynical individuals online who make themselves yeah. seem like they're a much larger number, to the point where Disney has to eventually do a mea culpa and realize that they got played. But there is this yeah. kind of, like, panicky thing where voices on the internet are disproportionately loud and disproportionately part of the conversation. I say as yeah. a voice on the internet, but things like,
wow.
Like
yeah.
I remember, like, Snakes on a Plane, which is a movie that yeah. the internet willed yeah. into existence, but nobody yeah. went to see because the internet nobody is not it. Real life. This yeah. this week you have things like the people being amazed that people are watching House of the Dragon because of the internet's wisdom that, like, Game of Thrones was hated by absolutely everybody.
Game of Thrones.
Yeah, and yeah. it's like, were you paying any attention? The actual surveys of audiences said they thought the ending was mostly fine. They've been yeah. streaming it in lockdown. It's still been the most pirated show on television 3 years after it ended. It is HBO yeah. Max's biggest streaming hit, even though, like, it's been over for 3 years. Of course people tuned into House of the Dragon.
Yeah, yeah.
Just because the internet was kind of angry about it doesn't mean that translates in any real way.
They're not angry anymore, yeah. Plus, you know, House of Dragon being very very good and compelling might have something to do with it.
That does help. Well, I mean, it grows its audience, to be fair. That's the thing. Like, yeah. it growing its audience week on week is testament that it's a good show itself. But the fact that people tuned in for that first episode is the kind of like the watermark of, yeah, I mean, the internet may be angry.
Oh, it was, yeah. Yeah. It was strong from the beginning. Yeah. Backtracking is back for an all-new season. Hi, I'm Caliban.
And I'm Gooey Fame.
And we'd like to introduce you to Backtracking, the podcast that explores the real-world inspirations behind your favorite episodes of Star Trek.
From historical events to classical literature to blockbuster films, we go where no pod has gone before to seek out the origins of classic Trek tales.
Did you know, Gooey, that the TNG episode Too Short a Season was an allegory for the Iran-Contra affair?
Yeah, only sweatier. Did you know that the Enterprise episode Regeneration was an homage to the John Carpenter film The Thing?
Archer and T'Pol freezing to death over a bottle of whiskey would have been a controversial ending.
As a dog lover, Archer would not like The Thing, I'm guessing.
Oh my god, movie night is canceled. Join us every other Thursday for a journey back to the beginnings of the Trek universe.
Backtracking is available wherever you get your podcasts.
No, Porthos!